because you're jumping back into the gap. All right, to coach, it's either sideline, two on the side, three on the side. That's off the second cut. Lead the country in offensive rebound.
Hey, coach, welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver. Let's share the game. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. Excited today to have Matt Langell with us. Coach, tremendous success at Colgate. And just off air, we're talking about the sustained success that you've had since you've been there in 2011, going into your ninth year this year. And first off, thanks for coming to the podcast and welcome.
I really appreciate you having me. It's great to be on.
Coach, when I did a bit of a dive in your program, and I certainly wasn't aware of the level of success, and it's been tremendous. And a lot of coaches saying a lot of really good things about your program and how you do things. And one of the interesting facts that came out suggested that you guys play a lot of basketball as a coaching staff. Can you talk about that and then maybe how that's influenced maybe how you coach or how you interact with your players?
Certainly. I think going back, I was a young head coach. I got hired at 34 years old. And when I built my staff, I think that, you know, I was fortunate enough to have some guys who were successful playing the game who are also very young. So, you know, over the last 7-8 years, you know, we've had guys 40 and under who were all very good players who had remained in shape and loved to play the game. And I think it's what got us into coaching is when we couldn't play anymore. It's the next closest thing maybe. But yeah, so whether it was playing 2-on-2 or 3-on-3 or 1-on-1 as a staff, or really started to work with some of our guys in that capacity, I think that you don't have to have been a former player to be a successful coach, but, you know, being able to get out on the floor and show the guys and interact with them and teach them what you've learned over time as a player, little tricks of the trade, serve to help us. You know, in our 8 years, we've had a number of transfers who had to sit out that year. And so, you know, sometimes on game days, those days can be difficult for guys who aren't in the rotation or guys who are sitting out that year in residence. And, you know, so to create a little game day atmosphere and play some 3-on-3 half court, you know, using some of the action that you're teaching them and going over the different reads and, you know, showing them that it's not always speed and strength and athleticism that can lead to success on offense and defense. You know, the value of intelligence and understanding, deception, you know, has certainly been part of what I think has helped us grow a program.
Well, it's great. And no doubt it shows your passion for the game to your players as well as all those old man moves that I know we call intelligence, but they're just, the game slows down as you get older. And that's really cool that you guys do that. And I know another thing is that you've mentioned before is that it's a player's game. Can you talk about that in the context of your program, what that means to your team?
Yeah, I mean, I think big picture, it's part of why I love basketball. It's, you know, you can see the emotion of the players when you're a fan. There's no huddle every play like American football or, you know, I love baseball, but, you know, there's, you know, so much still action for a number of the guys who are in the game, let alone in the dugout. The players have to make the plays in basketball. And so often, I mean, like, you know, every couple seconds, not just with the basketball, but away from the basketball and on the offensive end and the defensive end. So they're going to be the ones who determine the outcome. You know, can a coach steal a couple points in a game, you know, here and there by being intelligent or changing defenses? Certainly they're part of the game, but, you know, it's the players are going to determine the results, both individually and how they play collectively. So I think that's how we approach coaching the game. You know, we need to find the best young men for Colgate University and to be a part of the basketball team here. And then as coaches, we need to take those individuals. And because they're not always going to be the same 1 year to a next or a different recruiting cycle or what have you. And we need to figure out, you know, how that group together is going to maximize who they can be. And so you can have success a lot of different ways. That's just how we think of things. So we don't have a specific system. You know, we play against a lot of Princeton offense. And look, Coach Beilein and his two guard stuff is you can't be any more successful. And, you know, I worked for a guy named Fran Dunphy who replaced John Chaney, who, you know, he had his own system. And then recruited players to really fit that system. We just do it a little bit different in that, you know, we try and take the guys that we have and help them find success. You know, if we have a center who's a great 3-point shooter, we've got to do stuff differently than if we have a you know, a low post guy who, you know, needs to be in and around the basket.
It's really good stuff. And we're going to go a lot of different places, I'm sure, in this conversation, but sticking to this a little bit, because what you're really talking about to a certain extent is that, like a lot of places, you don't always get your first choice of player, but you're still trying to fit the mold of player that you want. But within who you've got to figure out a way to leverage their advantage, make them the best player they can be for what you want. So maybe you can talk about that. Like, how individually can you help players leverage their advantage as a player?
Yeah, I think just what you said, you've got to figure out what their strengths and what their weaknesses are. And look, we don't just, you know, recruit hazardly. There are certain things that we value. I mean, you know, if you look at our statistics over the years, you know, we've been a fairly efficient offensive group. Well, I mean, we tend to recruit guys who are, you know, typically good decision makers and have some intelligence about their game, have some signs of being skilled at the game, whether they're, you know, good shooters or passers or dribblers. Certainly they use those things to, you know, have relative success to get them to the point where we get them. And, you know, maybe they've sacrificed some athleticism or speed or jumping ability, you know, for us in the recruiting process. But I do think you have to say, okay, this guy's a little bit slow of foot. So, you know, he doesn't get by quite as well. So what can we do? If you just stick him in an ISO situation, you're handicapping him and you're not taking advantage of his strength. So, you know, how can we get him a step on his teammate or on the defense, whether that's with, you know, some sort of screening action or cutting away from the basketball or, you know, trying to create a closeout for him to attack as opposed to, you know, giving him the ball off of a screen the way that Larry Brown did Allen Iverson. Well, you just had to get him the ball at a certain spot on the court and he was going to be able to make something happen. So I just think you have to try and, again, really be intentional about your evaluation of your players, what their strengths are, what their weaknesses are. Obviously, while you're working on, you know, helping them improve at what they can. So, you know, for us, footwork is a big part of it. You know, being able to play off both pivot feet, being on balance, you know, not predetermining what you're going to do, trying to help your players have a variety of options in whatever circumstance that they're going to find themselves in, especially on the offensive end of the court.
Oh, we're going to talk about your efficiency because, again, I know you value analytics and you guys have been very efficient with offense, but you said something that is very, very important, I think, for coaches to understand. You said no predetermined movement, no predetermined decision. Does that apply in all circumstances within, say, an offensive set or an action you run, that your players have freedom of decisions? Is that what you're referring to when you say that?
Absolutely. I think that I stop practice all the time and I say, you know, you just chose to go drive it to the baseline. Like, who told you to go to the baseline? I want them to understand that the defense really dictates the decision that they're going to have to make. Now, it's what's wonderful about our game that happens in a snap of a finger. And so you can't make that decision for them. The player has to be ready to make that decision. So, you know, let's just use for an example, ball screen. Like, there's a variety of different ball screen coverages, right? So as soon as one is going to happen, we'll have tried and worked on, like, if they're going to ice or down a side pick and roll against us. I can't tell our guy exactly what to do, but we go over a variety of options and practice in 2-on-0 and 3-on-0 situations, you know, before we build up to 3-on-3, what may be available in that down situation. And so again, for each guy, meaning if we have a guy setting the screen who can make a 3-point shot and they're trying to ice or down the side ball screen, there are a variety of different options than if that guy has to be a guy who's going to dive to the rim because of his skills and where he's at in the point of his career. So, but I can't say, hey, if they ice the ball screen, then you throw it here all the time. There's got to be reads and teamwork involved. And so that's kind of how we approach teaching the game.
Well, I love that because, again, the game it's a game of possibility. It's not a game of exact solutions, especially when we're talking about decision making. So I love the way that you phrase that. And then the other part that goes with that is that I think sometimes too often, and this is why it's important for coaches to hear what you're saying, is that too often the coach dictates the player's decision because they don't give them the freedom of decisions, the freedom of possibilities. So I love that part of it. Is this something that you evolved to, or is this something through the mentors that you've had, you've learned, or is this just simply as a player, this is what you experienced was the most valuable thing for you?
No, I'm appreciative of you asking that question. I've had, I mean, in some ways, it's been the most distinct privilege of my career. In some ways, I'm jealous of others who get to learn from so many different people. I played for a coach named Fran Dunphy, who recently retired. And then I had the chance to work for him 2 years at my alma mater, University of Pennsylvania, and 5 at Temple. And I wouldn't be here today. I mean, literally, his team's had so much success that as a young head coach, I got a Division I head coaching opportunity. But, you know, how he taught the game and how he teaches life, I think it was just that. He'd certainly always recognize that there was no one right way to teach the game, but how he taught us the game as players. And then as I realized as an assistant coach working for him, that it's a decision-making game. You know, you can't run, you know, I'll just use, you know, Peyton Manning. You can't run play Omaha and execute it the way that New England Patriots do. And it you guarantee success. Like, you have to be able to, you know, read the defense and make decisions. And then one player's decision has to then affect the next player's choices and decisions from there. So yeah, it's, I would say 100%, you know, how I've learned the game and how I've come up. And then as we work, we're constantly trying to get better and studying over other programs. Nothing that we do did we invent. You know, we steal from stuff from coaches, you know, throughout the world whenever we can. And so it's definitely been a learned thing to try and teach our guys the options that are available and what their you know, decisions can be as they are in the moment.
Well, it's great. There's going to be a ton of coaches stealing from you now after this, which is super as well. So, Coach, just wanted with you again, let's go back to this question of efficiency on offense. Like, I don't know if there's specific actionable things that we can say. If you do these things, they lead to better efficiency. But are there certain things that you could say, hey, if you do these things, it leads to more efficiency on offense, something that you've found through your years?
Sure. Don't turn the basketball over. I mean, it's kind of simple, right? And like, you know, I go back to being a player and, you know, you would always know when your team had made a bad choice and the coaches, you know, face turns purple and, you know, he's ready to rip out his hair. Like, you see that on the sidelines all the time. But, and of course you're going to have turnovers, especially if you play with freedom and have freedom of choices, but it directly affects efficiency, right? A null possession is about the worst thing that you can do for your offensive efficiency. You have no chance to score. So I don't think that's rocket science or advanced analytics, but you know, that's how kind of simple it can be. So, you know, players
coach,
have to
just on that, sorry to interrupt, but just on that, is a bad shot better than no shot then?
Well, sure, because that in terms of offensive efficiency, it is. In terms of winning a game, sometimes not, because right. You know, bad shots are often lead to good scoring chances for the opposition, right? So sometimes a dead ball turnover where you get to set your defense and make the offense really work is better than a poor shot where you don't have good floor balance, where you don't have good offensive rebounding opportunity, where the opposition can lead to an easy transition basket, be a 2-point shot or a 3-point shot. So I wouldn't say that any shot is better than no shot, but again, just looking at the efficiency equations, I'm not the math guru on our staff, but I resort more to the common sense of what analytics provide. You need to work hard to get good shots. And I think that's kind of been the mainstay of how we teach our players, that if they understand the value of a good shot, again, you know, not just statistically, but, you know, in terms of chemistry, like if the team is committed to working hard to get a good shot, then you eliminate, you know, selfishness and you eliminate, you know, some of the negative thoughts that can harm a team.
It's a great point about the chemistry of shot selection. And so let's dive into the shot selection just a little bit before we come back to efficiency then. How are you educating your players? What's the best method you found for your team and your program to be able to educate players about shot selection?
Yeah, I think, you know, we talk about taking good shots. And so, and then, you know, when there's moments, whether it's in a practice or on film, where we have worked hard to get a good shot, you know, I love to stop the film before the ball has gone in the basket and say, well, what do you think? Is that a good shot? Meaning extra pass, feet set, on balance, good spacing, you know, shot clock is, you know, it's not a contested shot early in the shot clock. Are you going through all those checkpoints in your head? And then if you are, does everybody feel good about that shot? Meaning, you know, it's a guy who's in the gym all the time and he's practicing 3-point shooting and he makes them all more than he misses them in practice. Well, that's great. And if the ball goes in the basket, perfect. We'll run back and play defense. And if it doesn't, no big deal, because the reason we're running offense is to get shots that we believe are good shots. And so there's some variety within a team as to what a good shot is, meaning we've got, you know, a young guard who is terrific mid-range jump shooter. And so, you know, I know in today's day and age that that's like, oh, don't shoot a mid-range 2-point shot, but, you know, he's really good at shooting them. So I think the team recognizes that, you know, if he can get those, if we can get him a closeout and he can attack a guy and that guy's backing up and their defense isn't helping off our other 3-point shooters, then that's a great shot for our team. So I think just through conversation, I think that's how people learn is, you know, where's the focus and, you know, what's being talked about. You know, we do the flip side as well, meaning a guy shoots a contested step off jump shot and it's early in the clock. I don't want to berate that individual, but I'll stop in practice and tell him, hey, how much time was left on the clock? Typically, they don't know how much time is left on the clock when they're choosing to shoot a shot like that. You know, if he says, hey, coach, I thought there was 4 seconds left and that was the best shot we can get, at least he's thinking about the value of shot selection. And so that's kind of over time, I think our group has really learned that. I often think it's their character, meaning if you have selfish individual players who aren't invested in getting the best shot for the team, you know, they're less likely to make the extra pass or, you know, celebrate an assist attempt. You know, again, regardless of whether the ball goes in, assist attempts are fantastic.
So coming back to efficiency then, don't turn it over. What are some other things that lead to high efficiency offense?
Yeah, I mean, I think in college basketball, we want to shoot open shots. And if that presents itself early in the shot clock in transition while the defense is backing up and on their heels and we can, you know, get some initial attack, whether it's through a ball screen or just playing downhill and we can get drive and kick 3-point opportunities, that's terrific. But after that, you know, I mean, 30-second shot clock, it's hard to play solid defense, you know, when you're not 18 to 23 years old for a full possession. We know because we try and do it on defense. And, you know, one little mistake on defense can lead to the opposition getting a great shot. So, you know, we try and use that strategy on offense for us. Let's work to break the defense down, because, you know, the likelihood over a possession, if we're passing and cutting and screening and moving the basketball inside and out and from one side of the floor to the other, they're going to make a mistake. And it's so much easier to get a good shot when the defense makes a mistake. And that's when you need to take advantage of it. A long closeout happens, let's attack the closeout and make a good decision and we'll get a good shot. You know, and I think the guys believe in that process and we work towards it and they've adapted it. And I think that's a big part of our efficiency is, you know, we don't always just take the first available shot. We work hard to get the best shot that we're going to get over a possession.
I imagine a lot of this, I've heard one of your assistants talk about this in another podcast, but about this shot grading chart, this yeah. Shot selection grading chart, like, I mean, it's maybe the most detailed one I've heard about. Maybe you've heard of other ones, but I don't know if you want to get into that. But does this relate back to your players? And what I'm curious more about, and maybe you can explain it briefly to coaches, but maybe what I'm curious more about is that sometimes does that create like a kind of a paranoia in a player initially, like a newcomer to your program about this kind of extensive grading of shots?
Yeah. So
what takes away freedom from them initially?
Yeah, so David Klatsky has, you know, he is a mathematician. I mean, when he graduated University of Pennsylvania, he went to work on Wall Street and was very successful because, you know, he's really sharp when it comes to numbers. And so in today's day and age, he loves to study the analytics. But it's interesting because I think the shot chart that you're talking about, it's one that, you know, he's talked to other coaches about. And I think Kyle Smith and his groups have kind of coined it a little bit. Like they have a 5-4-3-2-1 and a five, you're trying to get fives all the time. So we actually don't use that.
okay. Yeah.
So David has studied it and we've talked about it as staff, and what he has done is, you know, we keep statistics every preseason as we start practices and gear up. And so he gives each guy, because, you know, again, it goes back to what I was talking about with, you know, what is a 4-for-1 guy might not be a 4-for-another guy. And so instead of the players, we want the players to play with freedom and to make good decisions. And when we don't want to have happen what you just spoke to, so we never on film say, oh, this is a 5 or this is a 4 or this is a 3. So what he has done, this is certainly more for coaches, is, you know, based on the statistics of what, how guys shoot in shooting drills and in practice. And, you know, he gives them an assigned point per possession value, meaning if this is a wide open, you know, 3-point shot, you know, feet set, stepping into it in rhythm on a driving kick or kick out or what have you, then, you know, that guy has an expected value. You know, if he's a 40% 3-point shooter compared to a 30%, compared to a 25%. So he gives each guy a, you know, expected value for the various shots that they may take. We do not talk about it with them. Well, that's much more for our understanding and our evaluation, so that as we grade the film and watch the film, that we can say, are we really getting good shots? Meaning if they're leaving the worst shooter that we have open, that's not the same as the best shooter getting a wide open shot. So what is the expected value of that specific shot that we're getting?
Well, I appreciate you saying that, because again, that's always been a curiosity for me about even this analytics era, is that, and you seem to have a good understanding of blending the player and the coach kind of in the same mindset, because that's what really good coaches do, I think, is that you don't forget that you're coaching humans. So that you can kind of, you can paralyze your players by giving them too much of a understanding of some of these analytics and stats as well, potentially. So
I believe that. I believe that fully. And so, you know, a guy, we tell them to shoot all the time. Like let's shoot open shots. But I'll also tell a guy, like, especially in practice, like, is that a shot that you have been practicing? You know, we shoot every day for, you know, I don't know, 15 minutes or 20 minutes of a 2-hour practice. But like, are you in the gym before class, after class? Are you calling a coach to come back? Are you on the gun? Are you practicing that shot? Because if you are and you're making it, then we as a group, and again, I'm not afraid to share this in front of the team, we as a group want you to shoot that shot. But if you're not, then is that the best shot for our team? So there's no like, you know, hey, that's a 4 or that's a 5 or that's a 1 that we just shot right there. Again, we want them to be invested in the concept of it's the best shot for the team.
Yeah, it's great. And I'm glad we're having this conversation and went in that direction. Coach, another thing that, and I've watched some of your film and stuff like that, but your post players seem to be very impactful in the stuff that you do. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of the post? And it's not necessarily traditional post. It's not traditionally dump it in and post and all that. But what are some things that you're doing with post players to be able to have them make an impact on the game?
Yeah, thank you for that. I think today's day and age has gotten so perimeter oriented, and maybe for good reason. I mean, young people are shooting the ball from astounding distances at great percentages. But I think the game, again, it comes down to breaking down the defense. I think that, you know, in order to best break down the defense, which is what you're trying to do to get a high percentage shot, the ball has to change sides of the floor. But it also, you know, I believe in inside out basketball. And I think there's a lot of ways to get that done. Like, you can drive it in to again, get it out for open shots. And, you know, you can, you know, throw the ball into the post to be able to do that. And I think, you know, what we've tried to impart on our players is that, you know, that doesn't have to just be the guy who is the tallest guy on the floor. You know, we had a guard, you know, a handful of years ago now who was one of our first recruits. You know, and he was a biggish point guard, you know, 6'4", 6'5", handled the ball very well, was a very good athlete. His brothers played football at Michigan and Boise State, and his sister played, you know, volleyball at Pepperdine, I think. So, but he was not a good perimeter shooter. So, you know, he just 15 feet and out, like it was a train wreck, and he worked really hard on it, but he couldn't help him get there. So, you know, people backed up off of him. Well, you know, perfect. So if they're going to play him with a point guard, which in our league could be a 6 foot guy, well, let's teach him how to go inside. At the time, we happened to have a 6'10 guy who was a 40% 3-point shooter. So we could kind of invert those guys a little bit and get the ball after he, you know, initiated offense, find a time for him to get himself inside and throw it into him. And he could bully his way to the basket and get us a score. You know, he didn't have a plethora of, you know, moves down there, but he could get, you know, defenders again, because of his vision, he could get defenders to help a little bit. So as he kind of worked inside, you know, it was almost with a point guard's vision, and he could, you know, make, you know, assisting plays from out of the post. Obviously we do it with our bigger guys as well. And, you know, we just start real simple that catching the basketball is most important, and being on balance and, you know, reading the defense. Hopefully, again, in college, I don't think you have to have, you know, 6 post moves. If you can get to a spot and they choose not to help, then, you know, you have a good chance of getting yourself to the foul line or getting a good shot up there. And if they do help, we, you know, we work on getting the ball back outside. Again, why is that for an open shot? Sometimes against the less good defense, but, you know, against the best defense, it's to create a closeout. And then, you know, you have to attack that closeout and make a decision. And, you know, that's where the spacing of our offense and the timing of the actions are very involved. But we do believe that, you know, inside out is important, especially when you're trying to manage a game and control tempo. And if you're just firing away shots all the time, you kind of lose control of the rhythm of the game. And that works for some teams, you know, like the Rockets and the Warriors are, you know, have the pieces to be able to do that. But, you know, how our team has been built, it's been a big part of what we do, of trying to be able to take advantage of some matchups on the floor to be able to get the ball close to the basket.
Hey, Coach, just a quick interruption from the podcast. I just wanted to let you know I would love for you to join basketballimmersion.com, of course, to help support all the online sharing I do. But I don't want to interrupt these podcasts for ads anymore. From now on, ads for Basketball Immersion events and products will be at the end of the podcast. I hope you will check them out. For instance, this week I'm sharing information about our BI Training Academy in Palm Desert, California, August 12th to 16th. Go to www.basketballimmersion.com/BI-training to learn more, or listen at the end of this podcast for more information. Now let's get back to the podcast. Well, and it's noticeable, and that's great that obviously it's part of your defined philosophy. So maybe a follow-up question to that, because you mentioned you don't need a lot of moves. What are you specifically teaching then when they catch it in the post? Obviously catch it, or are you teaching, you know, advantage attack off the bounce? Are you talking, you know, they gap shoot? I imagine that's not a part of it as much, like that we want to get to the rim.
Yeah, I mean,
but
so
what are the things?
Yeah, so I mean, the first thing is being able to catch the ball with your feet. Like, I think a lot of young, bigger players, they try and keep their feet planted and reach to get the basketball. And so when they catch it, they're off balance, and then they want to kind of crash into the defender. So, you know, we teach our guys to go get the ball with their feet and catch on balance, because you're just a better basketball player when you're on balance. I don't know a better way to say it. You know, and then, you know, we'd like for you to catch it closer to the basket. And, you know, in theory, I think the best way to do that, and I've learned this from opposing teams, is, you know, unless you're the most physically talented guy on the floor, to be trying to shove and fight with somebody, wrestle with a guy in the post is not ideal. I think if you can get closer to the baseline and get behind the defense and kind of try and time your move to get position with when the pass is going to arrive, that's optimal. And then the last part for us is, you know, like working on dribbling with a big guy. So if he can dribble with both hands and, you know, kind of maneuver his way to the basket with strong dribbles in a one-on-one situation, protecting the basketball, if he can get towards the middle of the floor, there's just so many options. So again, if you're working on, you know, like and everybody's different. Some guys like to, you know, kind of hop into a two-footed stop in the middle of the floor where they're effective at shooting that jump hook so good, or some guys are a little bit better at one-twoing it in there. But, you know, if you can navigate on two or three or four dribbles to towards the middle of the floor, puts a lot of pressure on the defense. And so, you know, if they have to take that away so much and you have a little counter move back to the baseline, then I don't know how much more, you know, successful guys in the post need in college. Again, because if a double team or an overhelp comes, you know, you can get the ball out of there and attack from the perimeter. You know, you have, you're playing with your advantage situation.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, simplicity in every way, and it's effective simplicity. So off the ball then, in terms of post reaction, you've talked about that a little bit, about playing inside out. And obviously if they draw help, then you're looking to play to the perimeter. What are you teaching? Is it conceptual for your players to space and then read their check? Or is there a set reaction when it goes in the post? Are you running plays out of the post? What are you doing?
Yeah, I think it's more conceptual. So, you know, again, when the ball goes in the post, I really don't. I think it's, you know, the easiest for us to guard is when the ball goes in the post and four guys stand around and watch him. So we certainly don't want to do that. I think you've got to get some sort of movement on the weak side of the floor. I mean, we varied between spacing to the strong side corner and splitting off the elbow and doing a lot of that, or cutting through hard. I think that, you know, again, this goes back to me, our initial point here, that it's a player's game. I think we need to try and teach guys how to play. And so, you know, if that guy has a great advantage in the post and he's, you know, an effective scorer down there, well, we want to be able to give him some space. So how are we going to occupy the defense while not cutting in his way and getting in his way? If he's going to be more of a, you know, throw it back out and then go set an uphill ball screen or respace, then, you know, maybe we need to try and put some pressure on the basket with a hard basket cut to create some movement for the defense. So again, we try and teach our guys, like, you know, if your defender turns your head, well, that's a great chance to cut. Well, if your teammate cuts, well, you need to fill his space. Well, if your teammate's defender has got his eyes stuck on your teammate's stomach, well, maybe you could set a back screen here for him to cut to the basket, and then your guy's going to have to help, and you can be open while your other teammate is, you know, has the basketball in the post. So again, a lot of things go into that, and it's not easy to learn it all right away, but there's a progression and to our concepts, and that's, I don't know if that answers your question, but that's kind of how we try and teach them to read the game.
Yeah, no, it's great. I mean, again, it gives them, as you talked about from the beginning, there's freedom of decisions, and it's reading advantage, and that's really what it comes back to, and it's great. And I guess the part that all this, again, comes back to is, how do you guys practice? Like, what are the things that you're doing in practice that are giving your players better possibilities out of these decisions? Is it on air, meaning no defense? Is it a lot of, you know, offense versus defense, small-sided games? Is it 5-on-5? What does a practice look like at Colgate?
I would say all of the above. I do think, you know, I try and never forget. I'm getting further removed, but I will always try to never forget what it's like to be a player. So I think what I've learned in my time as a head coach, especially early on, a lot of times we were doing things so that I would feel comfortable. Like, oh, we covered that, so I check for me. Whereas in reality, sometimes less is more. And I think that, you know, I remember, you know, some of my overseas experiences as a player, you know, where you're only playing one game a week on a Saturday, and some of those practices just dragging and dragging and dragging on, because, you know, we're going over this set play or that set play. And I think that's not ideal for a player. Not that you always do things that are ideal for a player as a coach, but you know, you need them to be invested. I always found, again, as a player, it was more enjoyable to learn by playing, not, you know, as opposed to learn by listening or learn by watching. Not that you don't use those teaching strategies as well. So we do dummy offense. You know, we do have a number. Most of the actions that we use, whether it's a dribble handoff or a ball screen, or even if it's our 5-on-0 baseline drive or middle drive action, you know, we do have, you know, series of movements where, okay, we're saying, imagine that the defense has made this decision and this is your read, so that we're training in that capacity. But then, you know, we do a lot of build up. So we, you know, we're trying to do, you know, 3-on-3 on a side and 4-on-4. And as we move into 5-on-5, you know, that's, we also, you know, in teaching transition offense and decision making, we'll try and teach, you know, 5-on-4 and just try and create, you know, a lot of different situations and scenarios. Some of the drills are, you know, tweaked year to year, but, you know, trying to get them, I think it's, I mean, again, freedom of decision is what you termed it. I just call it decision making. To me, it's the most valuable part of the game. And you can't do that dummy offense. Like you have to learn by doing. And so, you know, we try and keep practices, you know, during the season under 2 hours, and we try and keep everybody engaged and involved while we're doing it. I don't like to have a lot of guys sitting out. So, you know, if we have a larger roster on a year, we often do 5-on-5-on-5 so that, you know, it's not guys sitting out for 2 or 5 or 8 or 10 minutes at a time, just kind of watching on the sideline.
Well, I like that. And just to, like, I call it freedom of decision making because unfortunately the interpretation of what decision making is sometimes not true.
Like, absolutely.
They think decision making is what they think, but really decision making means they have all these possibilities. And
sure.
I think coaches sometimes that's the reason. But coach, I love what you just said too. So, and I'm sure it's not equal, but basically from 1 to 15 on your roster, so to speak, they get an opportunity to practice. Right? Like the 15th player, the 12th player, they get a chance to practice. And I've seen other programs where they don't. It's a lot of those players are just guided defenders, or they don't really get a chance to actually play basketball and practice.
Yeah. I mean, to me, that's miserable.
Me too. I never understood that.
I was in that spot. And again, there's a lot of ways to be successful. But for me, you know, basketball is a fun game to play. And so, you know, obviously there's different roles within a team. And, but I think that, you know, when you talk about chemistry and camaraderie and what have you, that, you know, every guy has to feel like they're a part of it and they're invested and they're improving and contributing. And even if they may not, you know, even if they may not be, you know, playing in the game or getting a chance to make the big shot or, lock down the other team's, you know, leading scorer, whatever that assignment may be, that they feel like, you know, they're improving as a player and they're adding value and they're learning and they're enjoying the game that we love.
No, I love that. And I think it's so important because I think sometimes, like in this era especially, we have such specialists sometimes, or we're worried about workload management, all these different things, that we don't involve the whole team. And again, I mean, cohesion relates to practice more than anywhere else, I feel. So that's such a part of it, is making sure everyone feels involved. And as you said, improving, like that's such a cool part of that. So I'm glad you said that. I've also, coach, one of the original places I wanted to go with this was talking about adjustments and this concept of you see something in an opponent, whether it's an individual player, but let's focus more on they run something or they defend in a certain way. What are some things that help you as a coach decide what adjustments to make? And then maybe just start with the fact that you're willing to change to take advantage of what you see as potentially an advantage, I assume.
I mean, collaboration is big for me. I think a huge part of, you know, our growth from a program. I had won 7 games when we got here, won 8 games in our first year, and won 24 games in our 8th year has been the staff that I've been able to work with. I think they're deeply committed to the game and to our program, and most importantly to the individuals within our program. And they're comfortable sharing their opinion, you know, questioning things that I bring up, providing solutions and to what the opposition may be showing, again, in preparation for a scout. You know, we don't have an offensive and a defensive coordinator for that reason. I believe that part of why I was able to learn and grow as an assistant coach is that I was given a lot of freedom to learn in both ends of the basketball. So, you know, in a scout and a preparation, as they're, you know, looking at the opposition, I also want them to be thinking about, you know, what it is that we do that might have success against the team that we're playing and their defensive schemes. So I think that, it's a collective thought pattern. I don't feel like we ever change what we do in that, specifically on the offensive end, in that, very rarely are we saying, hey, let's take a look at this option or this action based on how they're playing that we've never done before. So, again, I think it speaks preparation is really important to us. And that's not just for a specific game, but it gets back to that main concept of it being a player's game. So, they need to be prepared for as many different scenarios and situations as possible. And if they are, then they can navigate that in game. So, we do say, okay, this is the coverage that you guys are seeing. I think that this action that we do all the time could be more effective than how we started, maybe a game or what have you. So I think those are more our adjustments than, kind of put in something that everybody else would view as new. Maybe we haven't done it in a while or yet that year, but I think for the guys, we very rarely ever try something, on the fly or on 2 days preparation that we haven't done before.
Of course. So it's you're leveraging an advantage based on something that you already have, but you see that an opponent has this type of coverage. So now we can apply this, A, B, or C that will work against it. And I guess maybe there's a curiosity from coaches listening to this. What type of offense are you generally running? Because obviously you said there's some decision making within each of the sequences. Is there a structure to unstructure? Or is it, are these sets? Is it motion? What are we talking about in terms of that?
Yeah, I mean, in transition, it's not really, there's no real secrets. I mean, in transition, again, we had some really good players on our team last year. I mean, we had the rookie of the year, we had the player of the year, and we had two other guys who were all league players. We had a guy on the all defense team. So we're really good players. We shot, just looking at our statistics here, we shot, in 35 games, we shot 815 3-point shots, and we shot, we shot 39, almost 39.5% from three. So, we've been able to space the floor well when we've got, that many guys who can make a 3-point shot. We've been able to space the floor in transition, a few different things. Obviously, ball screens, some 5-out ball screens, some 4-out 1-in. Ball screens and then teaching the guys the reads off that action, whether it's the two guys involved in the action or weak side cutting or and what the passes that could be available and where shots might be coming from. In the half court, we often utilize a little floppy action to start to try and get the defense behind or get it inside and get into a side ball screen continuity, 1-1-2-2 type look where we can, where we can swing and screen on the ball, or we can, dribble handoff. And then again, there's a variety of options that guy can cut, and it can be continuous, or he can, screen the corner and play from there. And again, just, trying to make it hard on the defense to keep everybody covered and create advantages for our guys on offense. We play off the elbows often, kind of have a variety of different things and cuts, but very rarely is it a play call. Maybe out of a timeout, we'll be looking for a specific option out of when we hit that elbow and we're cutting over the top or cutting to the weak side or what have you. Something quick hitting, but more often than not, it's 3 or 4 options off of an action that everybody knows. If that's the read that my teammate makes, well, changes what my next reads may be.
Well, and that's great. And again, it's a progression of reads and progression of decisions, and really, again, teaching players how to play. But I think sometimes when we say that, it doesn't get explained what that means. And I thought that was a great description of what it is. And the other part that comes with this, coach, is sometimes when people describe that, what I'm curious about, are there some automatics within that if this happens, we want this to happen.
If this, then that. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But say we're 4-out, 1-in and we're reversing the ball through the weak side trail forward. And he takes, then he's going to go dribble handoff at the weak side. Well, so in that dribble handoff, the defense can do a lot of different things. They could, jam the corner guy so that he can't use the screen. Well, if he does, then that guy's read is, you know, he's got to cut to the basket. And so if he does cut to the basket, now the guy who took the dribble handoff is kind of out on an island. Well, somebody's got to, you know, get open towards the top of the key so we can reverse the ball. And now we teach that guy who just, you know, going to pick up his dribble to go pin down the guy who was overplayed. Now, again, what the defense does from there, he may be open, slipping that screen and getting to the basket. The guy still may be playing top side. So, you know, the guy who cut back door may have to go out the other side. So again, there's absolutely a, you know, in my mind, a natural progression. That's how we never try and get a guy to move in an illogical manner to keep the offense moving. But there are a lot of, you know, if your teammate does this, the spacing and the defense in my mind dictates that this is where our next movement should be.
No, I love that. And again, that's such an important part to be able to define for your team is again, this is based on your philosophy, how you play and all this other stuff. And coach, maybe I got to ask too, you play against a lot of Princeton type stuff, a lot of these type of offenses. What are some things that you've learned to help defensively against these type of spread movement cutting type of offenses? Is there anything that kind of you can share that says, hey, listen, you know, this is something that if you have the right personnel, but this is something that can help disrupt these type of flows and these type of offenses?
Well, I mean, I don't know specifically. I mean, again, if you go back to the Kirill and the Bill Carmody Princeton, you know, the original Princeton offense that was so very disciplined and went so deep into the clock. I saw a stat the other day of like, you know, in the last number of decades, the best teams, you know, I don't know what the rankings were, whether it was Ken Pom or what have you, the best teams that played the slowest. And some recent Virginia teams were at the top. And then a number of those Princeton teams, 97, 98, 99, were also on there. So the cutting aspect was so important to those teams that, you know, I think it was at a time where everybody was dying passing lanes and trying to, you know, not let ball reversal happen. So if you did that they were so astute at throwing the backdoor pass to a cutter before he was open or before most of us would recognize that he was open, that you almost have to make it so that you're taking away their options. And so I think something for us that we have used in those situations is, you know, maybe we call it head and chest, so that instead of, you know, playing in the gap a little bit more and denying that passing lane, that you back up a little bit and kind of, you know, if that guy's going to cut, he's certainly not going to cut behind you with a passing angle available for that pivot. Typically that sends him into the dribble handoff, which creates its own difficulty. But, you know, it's a little bit easier in my mind when you take away those free points. And, you know, for those teams that I played against in the 90s, it was almost like that backdoor layup was worth more than 2 points for some reason, just towards momentum,
right,
and morale. And, you know, like it was so like, don't get back cut, that if you did, it was like totally deflating and they got an extra jolt out of it. So I think that was something that we learned back then is almost, you know, they have a variety of options and reading their offenses as well, or in that offense. And I think if you can take away one, it helps everybody else prepare for what, you know, might be coming next.
It's just, again, it's really fun exercise to think again about those things, but like their version of the dunk was a backdoor pass.
Yeah.
This is awesome. And, you know, again, these experiences that you derived, I mean, from obviously the different teams, I know you played against that a lot, so it's great. Coach, I can't thank you enough for taking some time. It's been wonderful to deep dive, and I didn't even realize that we've gone this long, because it's been so fascinating to hear your thought process on these things. So thank you for taking the time and sharing with us.
No, really appreciate it. I didn't realize we spent this much time either, so I think what you're doing is great. Again, today's today's day and age for the game to be so global and for coaches to be able to share. If there's ever anybody that wants more on a certain topic or anything else, just look us up, send me an email. Happy to share. I think that's how I've been fortunate enough to get to where I have, has been from learning from others. So, you know, we're always want to be accessible to anybody who's out there.
Well, that's tremendous to hear. And Coach, you're talking to the right audience, because past coaches that have had that have got bombarded with questions from coaches. So it's been so rewarding for me, and it will be. You'll hear from a lot of coaches after this, and we'll turn a lot of them into Colgate watchers on Synergy or Live or wherever they can find your game. So that's great, too, because I really enjoyed watching your games as I prepared for this, too.
That's terrific. Thanks so much, Chris. I appreciate what you're doing.
Thanks for listening to the podcast, Coach. I want to share with you something I'm so happy to finally be opening up. It's our basketball immersion training, or BI training. We were doing a live 5-day training camp specifically for college and pro players. It's taking place in my new hometown of Palm Desert, California, and the closest airport is PSP, or Palm Springs Airport. This location is just 2 hours from LAX and is a beautiful spot to learn a games approach and to improve decision making. I've had many coaches ask me over and over how to develop players and train decision-making in the off-season. Well, here it is, a 5-day player development academy in Palm Desert, California, August 12th to 16th, 2019. I'm running this basketball immersion training for your players to attend and learn through 8 on-court sessions, 3 video sessions, and group training practices like you've never seen before. You know my love for random practice and transferring skills to games, and these training sessions will be run with a player development focus. This is a full week of me teaching players to be their own coach and to make your life even easier. Come learn for yourself how to best teach your players to make better decisions through group off-season decision training. Send this link to your players ASAP, www.basketballimmersion.com/BI training. Come join me for a 5-day Player Development Academy in Palm Desert, California, August 12th to 16th, 2019. Hurry, spots are limited. To find out more about Coach and all we spoke about today, please take a look at the show notes for today's episode. I love to share the game and have basketball coaching conversations, so connect with me on social media. You can find all my social media information and all your membership, clinic, and consulting needs at basketballimmersion.com. That concludes today's episode. I know there are so many podcasts out there. Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Basketball Podcast with me, your host, Chris Oliver. Please subscribe and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues so that we can keep bringing you the best of what's out there and share the game.